So as I said, our passage this morning is Numbers chapter 23, verses 11 to 27. And although the title of this series is The Man Who Could Not Curse, which is of course a reference to Balaam, and although over the last few weeks I've been referring to these chapters in Numbers as the Balaam narrative or the Balaam story, it's important to remember that Balaam isn't the only significant character that we have here. King Balak is pretty significant too. He's not just an extra. He's not just performing some minor background role. Moses, as he writes these chapters, is interested in Balak. Indeed, he's interested in presenting Balak in a very particular way as a fool. As a fool. He really wants us to see Balak in that light. I've touched on this already in this series, but in this morning's passage, Balak's foolishness becomes even more prominent. It's very much to the fore in this section that we're looking at. And that being so then, I want us to do two things this morning. And first of all, let's enjoy Balak's foolishness. Let's enjoy Balak's foolishness. And we'll spend longer on this first point this morning. So let me remind you then of that neat parallel that's at the heart of the whole story. In chapter 22, Balaam's donkey makes a fool of Balaam. That's not my assessment of the situation. That's what Balaam himself says. Chapter 22, verse 29, speaking to the animal, he says, "You have made a fool of me." How does the donkey make a fool of Balaam? Well, because three times Balaam tries to get it to do something, to walk in a certain direction, and three times the donkey defies him and does something else. So that's what you have in chapter 22, but then you see in chapters 23 and 24, Balaam similarly makes a fool of Balak. How? Well, three times Balak tries to get Balaam to do something, to curse the people of Israel. And three times Balaam defies him and does something else. So you see that quite clear and unmistakable parallel that we have here. And perhaps indeed it can be pressed actually a little further. Because if you think about it, the donkey's first defiance, its first non-compliance with Balaam's wishes, it was relatively mild, wasn't it? It just kind of veered off the road into a field at the edge. No great damage was done, it seems. It was an eminently recoverable situation. And similarly, Balaam's first defiance, Balaam's first non-compliance with Balak's wishes, it was relatively mild. That oracle in verses 7 to 10 that we looked at last Lord's Day morning. Actually, Balak's reaction to it in verse 11, I think, is a little bit excessive when he says, "What have you done to me? I took you to curse my enemies, and behold, you've done nothing but bless them." It's true that Balaam hadn't cursed Israel, but neither had he exactly heaped blessings on them. He'd merely pondered a little Israel's freedom and Israel's size, as we saw last week. As I say, it was definitely non-compliance, but it was mild non-compliance. But then back to the donkey. And the donkey's second defiance, you remember, was more stark. It was painful for Balaam, as Balaam's foot, you remember, was pressed against the wall by the donkey. And similarly, Balaam's second defiance here in our passage in verses 18 to 24, it's more stark, it's more painful for Balaam. Indeed, right from the outset, there's an abrasiveness, isn't there, about Balaam's words this time. He says, "Rise, Balak, and hear. Give ear to me, O son of Zippor, there in verse 18. And whereas in the earlier oracle, Balaam spoke in somewhat gentle rhetorical questions. How can I curse whom God has not cursed? How can I denounce whom the Lord has not denounced? Verse 8. Now he speaks in robust, categorical statements. Verse 20. Behold, I received a command to bless. He has blessed, and I cannot revoke it. And you can sense a raw nerve being struck here in Balak. There's real agitation now in his response in verse 25. Do not curse them at all, and do not bless them at all. This is a man whose foot is being pressed against the wall. And so I'm saying then, just as the donkey had progressively stepped up its non-compliance and become gradually more stubborn and more resistant, Balaam's doing that with Balak. And in the process then, Balak is looking gradually more silly. He's been made a fool of. I mean, if it's humiliating for a man who keeps a donkey precisely for the purpose of getting him from A to B to be defied by that donkey and unable to get from A to B, if that's humiliating, it's even more humiliating for a powerful king who hires a prophet from miles away precisely for the purpose of cursing Israel to be defied by that prophet and unable to curse Israel. So Balak is being made a fool of by Balaam. But then there's something else going on compounding that, really. Balak is also, I think we're meant to see, making a fool of himself. We touched on this last week. I said then that it was counterproductive and self-defeating of him to only let Balaam see a mere fraction of the Israelites. It had the effect of freaking Balaam out more than if he'd been able to see the whole camp, I think. So that was Balak descending into foolishness, but that descent now continues and accelerates in this morning's passage. Imagine for a moment this scenario. Imagine that one Sunday I preach a really terrible sermon. Some of you are probably thinking that's not too hard to imagine. And during this sermon then, half of you fall asleep because it's just so boring, and the other half walk out because it's just so heretical. The sermon is that bad. Now you'd expect me, wouldn't you, subsequently to bin that sermon. You wouldn't expect it ever to see the light of day again. But imagine I don't bin it. Instead, I say, well, that didn't go brilliantly, but I know why. I didn't drink enough water. That's why half the congregation fell asleep and the other half walked out. I was a bit parched. So when I preach away in a couple of weeks' time, I'm going to preach that sermon again, but this time I'll take sips of water as I go along and it'll be fine. That'd be pretty stupid, wouldn't it? Taking sips of water is clearly not going to be a game changer, turning a boring and heretical sermon into one that's suddenly gripping and orthodox. And here's Balak then. And there's been this whole rigmarole aimed at producing a curse, the construction of seven altars and the offering on those altars of seven bulls, and then the offering on those altars of seven rams. And the whole thing has failed spectacularly to produce even the merest hint of a curse. Indeed, words of admiration and approval are all that have come out of Balaam's mouth. Nothing remotely curse-like. And if Balak had an ounce of common sense then, he would be scrapping the project now, wouldn't he? Recognizing it's backfired badly and sending Balaam home to Pethor as soon as he possibly can before any more damage is done. But that's not what he does in verses 13 and 14. Instead, he says, I know what the problem is. I chose the wrong spot. Silly old me taking Balaam to Bamoth Baal. Schoolboy error, that one. Of course, it's the field of Zophim. That's where we need to be. We need to build all our altars there and offer the bulls there and offer the rams there. I mean, this is off the scale stupidity that we're witnessing here. Taking sips of water is not going to make that failed sermon suddenly effective, and moving to a different spot, it's not going to make this failed cursing procedure suddenly effective. And Balak doesn't come out with this blithering nonsense just once in our passage. He comes out with it twice. In verse 27, there's yet another geographical relocation. And in fact, there at the end of the passage, the man's stupidity comes across in an even more pronounced way, because for one thing, notice he's becoming virtually incoherent by this point. One minute he's saying in verse 25, do not curse them at all and do not bless them at all. In other words, no more attempts to curse them now, Balaam. It's safer if you just keep your mouth shut from now on. Before the next minute, he's saying in verse 27, come now, I'll take you to another place. He's kind of lurching recklessly here from one option to another in his desperate frenzy. On the one hand, appalled by what's coming out of Balaam's mouth, while at the same time tantalized by the thought of some curse eventually escaping Balaam's lips. And then for another thing, there's the way that in verse 27, he now spells out exactly what it is that he's hoping for. Perhaps, he says there in verse 27, perhaps it will please God that you may curse them for me from there. It's actually stronger than that in the Hebrew. He says, perhaps it will be right in God's eyes that you will curse God, that you will curse them for me. I mean, is this man insane? Why on earth would it be right in God's eyes that his own people be cursed? Imagine Vladimir Putin calling President Biden one day and saying, look, Joe, I'd like to drop a nuclear missile on New York City. Just blow the place into smithereens. Is that okay with you? You okay for my fighter jets just to come into your airspace, let's say tomorrow morning, so that we can get on with it? That kind of phone call is unthinkable. The idea of President Biden being favorably disposed toward a nuclear attack on New York City wouldn't so much as cross the mind of any rational person. And the idea of God being favorably disposed toward curses raining down on Israel wouldn't cross the mind of any rational person, but it crosses Balak's mind in verse 27, because this man is becoming less and less of a rational person with every passing verse here. He's becoming an out-and-out fool. And Moses, the author here, is parading Balak's foolishness. He could have written this story very differently, couldn't he? Just a few lines, something like, Balak, king of Moab, attempted to defeat the Israelites by a strategy of bringing curses down on them. However, God thwarted the attempt so that it was unsuccessful. Moving on. And Balak then would have come across as this daring and dangerous enemy who thankfully couldn't quite pull off his sinister plan. But that's not how Moses writes this story. Indeed, he seems to rather enjoy portraying Balak as a fool, kind of lingering over the man's foolishness and savoring it. Indeed, he seems to want us to enjoy it with him. Hence my heading, let's enjoy Balak's foolishness. And I don't think this is because Moses just has a warped sense of humor. It's because of something else. It's very interesting that other biblical writers actually take a very similar approach to Moses. Especially the author of the book of Judges does. I think he and Moses would have got on like a house on fire. The author of Judges, he wants us to enjoy the foolishness of King Eglon's servants. Do you remember them? Do you remember how they assure themselves that their master, another king of Moab incidentally, is just having a long session in the toilet, when really he's been killed by God's servant, Ehud. And the same writer wants us to enjoy the foolishness of Sisera's mother. Do you remember how she assures herself that her son and a Canaanite army commander is just taking a long time in battle, because there's so much plunder that needs to be distributed and sorted out, when really he's been killed by God's servant Jael with her famous tent peg? Why then are we encouraged in the Bible to enjoy this kind of thing? Well, we talk, don't we, about getting a bird's eye view on things. We say, I'll climb up there and I'll get a bird's eye view. The Bible wants us to have a God's eye view. A God's eye view on those who fiercely and ferociously oppose his cause. I know I used a spider illustration last week, but I hope you won't mind me using another one. On Wednesday evening, there was a large specimen here in this room, as some of you may have been aware. Now let's think of a couple of different ways then in which you could view that spider as it crawled along the carpet about where Mike and Pat are sitting just now. So first then, there's the Talitha Peters perspective. Now, Talitha wasn't here on Wednesday evening, but if she had been, she'd have gone into panic mode. She'd have retreated at the very least to the foyer, possibly out into the car park. If a spider's ever seen in her bedroom, that's it. She's sleeping somewhere else that night. We might as well just sell the house, in fact, and move somewhere else. It's that catastrophic. So there's the Talitha Peters perspective on that spider on the floor. But then secondly, there's the Hannah Taylor perspective, whereby you just laugh cheerfully at this creature that's so feeble and powerless that all it needs is a piece of paper and a glass from the kitchen to entirely remove it from the building, and you get on and do that as she did on Wednesday evening. So two quite different perspectives. And as you and I live in this world then, that's apparently full of threats to Christianity, whether it's the new sexual morality that has swept through Western societies at such a rapid pace, or whether it's radical Islam with its world-conquering ambitions, or whether it's Satan himself who's so devious in his temptations and seems to be engulfing the church these days in leadership scandal after leadership scandal. As we live in such a world surrounded by so many threats, we can adopt either one of those two perspectives in my illustration. We can go into panic mode. We're doomed, we can cry. Christianity is on its way out. It's in terminal decline. Or we can laugh at the feebleness and powerlessness and preposterousness of those threats. And the second of those is God's perspective. We sang, didn't we, from Psalm 2 this morning about God laughing. He's no more fazed by today's cultural Marxism or Islam or indeed by Satan himself than Hannah Taylor was by that spider. And one day soon he's going to come along with his piece of paper and his glass and he's going to pop them all right out of his universe. And in these passages in Judges then, and in this passage here in Numbers, we're being invited to share God's perspective, to enjoy with him the foolishness of his enemies, to stop panicking that some ideology out there or some religion out there is going to spell the demise of the Christian church. We've been invited to hear the contagious laugh of our Heavenly Father, the King of the cosmos. And we've been invited to take a bit of that laughter up onto our own lips. Every threat to the cause of God in 2024 is just another Balak, really. Ridiculous and absurd and asinine. Our God laughs, and we may share his laughter. Let's enjoy Balak's foolishness. But then secondly this morning, let's examine Balak's foolishness. Let's examine Balak's foolishness. And I'm thinking then particularly of that comment there in verse 27 that I've already mentioned. Perhaps it will be right in God's eyes that you may curse them for me. And I said then, that is foolish. That is foolish, and indeed it is. But we need to realize that as Balak made that comment, the princes of Moab who were standing by, they wouldn't have sniggered under their breaths. Indeed, any Moabite who had been within earshot and had heard those words in verse 27 that their king spoke, none of them would have sniggered under their breath. Indeed, anyone under the sun, anyone from any nation in the world at that time, apart from Israel, anyone would not have sniggered under his or her breath as Balak spoke those words in verse 27. To any non-Israelite inhabitant of this world, it would have seemed perfectly reasonable, the idea that a God might suddenly decide to curse his own people. Why, for goodness sake, shouldn't any self-respecting deity behave like that? That would have been the almost universal attitude. So why then are we saying that that comment in verse 27 is so foolish? Perhaps you've had that experience where something is said or done that makes you laugh out loud, but you suddenly realize you're the only person in the room who's finding this funny, and no one else laughs, and people kind of look at you, and then someone asks, well, how was that funny? And you kind of struggle to explain. The thing felt funny to you, but now that all these very serious blank faces are staring at you, you can't really articulate a reason, and you start to wonder if it really was all that funny after all. And here then, given that virtually no one else in the ancient world would have found Balak's remark in verse 27 laughable, perhaps we shouldn't be laughing. Perhaps it's not really foolish and funny after all. Well, that's where Balaam's oracle in our passage comes in handy. Balaam's oracle highlights for us why verse 27 is ridiculous. Yes, 99.9% of the gods of the ancient world might have been gods who could quite easily curse their own people one day. But Balaam's oracle highlights why all those gods are ridiculous. It highlights that thankfully there's a true God who is altogether different from them. And two quick things then from Balaam's oracle as we close. Notice, first of all, the true God doesn't flit. The true God doesn't flit. That's the point, isn't it? So clearly made in verse 19. God is not man that he should lie, or a son of man that he should change his mind. The true God doesn't flit from fad to fad, from whim to whim, from impulse to impulse. He's consistent. He sticks with things. The gods of Balak's pagan world were volatile and erratic and unpredictable. But the true God isn't like that. That's what verse 19 is saying. He's steady and he's stable. Indeed, the meaningfulness of verse 22 entirely depends on this point. Notice there, Balaam mentions the Exodus. God brings them out of Egypt. Now, Balak knew about the Exodus just as much as Balaam knew about the Exodus. But Balak's attitude would have been, well, that was then. That was in the past. Why should that make any difference whatsoever to how God relates to Israel now in the present? Why should the fact that he redeemed his people from Egypt some decades ago, why should that mean that he won't curse them today? But Balaam's point, you see, is that having brought Israel out of Egypt, then there's no way he's now going to turn around and let them be cursed. It's a logic that would have sounded like a foreign language to Balak. Everything in his theology reinforced the notion that what God did yesterday has no bearing on what he might do today. He'd never heard of a God that does not flit. Because the foolish, the false gods of this world are foolish. But there's a true God, Balaam is saying. There's a true God who doesn't flit. And that's why then he can mention the past Exodus as something that's relevant to the present situation, as something that rules out the possibility of God now allowing Israel to be cursed. And I just want to remind you, Christian believer, of this wonderful truth that our God doesn't flit. I mean, we all know that, right? But we all know it until something goes wrong. And some difficult set of circumstances suddenly engulfs our lives. And we suddenly start to wonder, is God against me? Is God actually ill-disposed toward me? Is he my enemy that he's allowing this to happen to me? Well, you see, that's the theology of Balak in verse 27, rather than of Balaam in verse 22. It's the Balak principle that suddenly it might be right in God's eyes for me to be cursed, rather than the Balaam principle that the God who has rescued me, and rescued me not only from Egypt, but from sin and from Satan's domain and from the road to hell, the God who has rescued me once will not some point in the future turn against me and curse me. That's impossible. That's ridiculous. He must always be for me. He must always be on my side. The God of Calvary, the God of Good Friday, must always have my best interests at heart. That's Balaam theology, not Balak theology. May you and I be clear. May we be clear that God does not flit. And when things are bad and when things are hard and when seasons of calm and peace give way to seasons of turmoil and stress, that's not because God has turned. That's not because he's decided to curse instead of bless. He has his reasons that he doesn't need to share with us why the calm circumstances have been exchanged for tumultuous ones. But he still has the same smiling face behind the dark providence. He's still for us. He's still the God who did not spare his own son in order to rescue us from our sin. We need to cling to that. and cling to it with all our might. The true God doesn't flit. And then the second thing that's so highlighted in Balaam's oracle is that the true God doesn't fail. The true God doesn't fail. You see, Balak would have been used to the idea of a whole load of gods, none of whom was absolute, but all kind of jostling with each other and to some extent limiting each other. None able to accomplish all his goals and succeed in all his plans. But not the true God. The true God, and this is going to sound odd perhaps for a moment, but bear with me on this. The true God had a plan. A plan to rear a lion. Balaam talks about that in verse 24. Now there in verse 24, the lion that he talks about seems to be Israel as a whole. But if you go to Genesis 49, verse 9, where Jacob is speaking just before he dies, he specifically singles out one tribe within Israel, Judah, and identifies it as the lion. But then, of course, as the Bible goes on, that focus gets narrower still. And the lion that God is rearing turns out ultimately not to be a nation or even a tribe, but an individual. And Revelation 5 verse 5 refers to the lion of the tribe of Judah. It's Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ is the lion whom God was going to rear. And if Balak then can secure here a curse on Israel, God's lion-rearing plan is going to fail. Because that lion is going to come from Israel and from one tribe within Israel. So if Israel is wiped out here with a curse, that plan is going to fail. And that would have been no big deal in Balak's foolish pagan theology. But Balaam is saying the true God, he can't fail. His plans don't fail. If he has set out to rear a lion, then a lion is going to be reared. That lion must come. It has to come. It will come. Jesus Christ, the lion of the tribe of Judah, must step onto the stage of history. And I just want to close this morning speaking to any of you here who may not be Christians. And I want to just press home then on you this idea that 2,000 years ago, a lion stepped on the stage of this world. Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ is a lion. Perhaps you've not heard of that or thought of that before. But if Jesus Christ is a lion, then there are for every human being, the Bible indicates, two alternative possibilities. One is a very scary one that's mentioned there in verse 24. Balaam talks about this lion devouring, consuming. Again, you may not have heard Jesus Christ spoken of in those terms, but the Bible clearly indicates that a day is coming when Jesus Christ is going to pounce on all those who have rejected him and devour them. And that will be a terrifying day and an awful day. And that's one of the possibilities then that confronts every single human being, the possibility of remaining an enemy of Jesus Christ, a rejecter of Jesus Christ, and one day that lion pouncing. The other possibility, however, was there in our other reading this morning, in Hosea chapter 11. Do you remember how Hosea 11 verses 10 and 11 spoke of a lion roaring, but not roaring because about to devour, but roaring to summon, to call people, to follow him, to gather to him, and to know him, and to be under his protection. That's the roaring of Hosea chapter 11. And Jesus Christ then, the lion, he, while you're still alive and while history continues, Jesus Christ is roaring in that sense to you. He's roaring this morning, an inviting roar, a calling roar, a summoning roar. He's saying, come, come to me, this mighty lion that I am. Come and find protection and security with me. He wants to be your lion this morning. He doesn't want to pounce on you and devour you at the end of the age. He will do that if it's necessary. But he doesn't want to do that. He wants you to come to him this morning, to heed the roar, and to come trembling in the language of Hosea 11, to come trembling to him and to cling to his mane. That's what he wants. And so I close urging you, if you've not yet heard the roar and gone to Jesus Christ, the lion, to do that this morning. To run to that strong, magnificent, invincible lion. To make the one who would otherwise be your enemy your protector. Go to Jesus Christ. Go this morning. May God bless his word. Amen.